to the Sweeney Connection with your host, Chad Henderson.
That's me. I'm Chad Henderson.
It's always you.
It's always me, isn't it?
Yeah.
You were just looking at me, just seeing what I was going to say there.
I was anticipating something different, but
yes, for sure.
You got to stay with what works.
That's right. Yeah. Welcome to the Sweeney Connection, parents and campers and friends of Camp Sweeney, and thanks for tuning in today. And Bob Cannon, our co-host, and my name's Chad Henderson, and our very special guest today is Dr. Shomo Adhikari, and today we're going to be talking about treatment of diabetes and sort of the medical side of the disease and sort of where how it began and kind of where we're going with it. And Dr. Adhikari, I'd just like to know, to start off, just sort of how did you get involved with Camp Sweeney and sort of what's your primary role here?
Yeah, thanks for the introduction. First off, it's kind of exciting to see how many things have developed over the course of the last several years, but this is as high on the list as anything as we try to get our word out about what it is that we're doing and such. So it's great to be here. I was a fresh trainee out of medical school in about 2001 when I first moved to Dallas. So I moved here for residency. Those are the first few years after medical school, and reasonably early in residency, you are probably all things at once. You're overwhelmed with everything that you're kind of being exposed to. As a trainee, in my case, I was overwhelmed by being exposed to a new city as well. And also, there's this little pressure that sort of builds over the first several months of residency of, what am I going to do with my life after training is over? Mm-hmm. And it's about a year in, or it used to be about a year in. Now you have a little bit more time, but it used to be about a year into that three-year training roadmap that you really start having to face some of those decisions about what you're going to do. And I had my eyes open to two things reasonably early in the course of my first year in Dallas. And one was the kids with diabetes who I had a chance to run into just over and over again in the hospital for one reason or another. And two, honestly, was the team that was there present at Children's, some of whom is still there right now. And both, I felt like I made a connection with a lot of my colleagues in the department who I still consider friends and colleagues today. And everything from, the kids, their stories, their physiology, everything just kind of resonated with me. And I started exploring that in greater depth and kind of asking myself, hey, is this something I could really see myself doing? And the initial decision was that, yeah, I want to throw myself into this. I want to devote my professional career to endocrinology, to diabetes care. And then somewhere along the way, many people who are listening to this podcast probably will remember Brian Dixon. He was medical director back then. He brought me up to camp one Friday night after a week where we had been on service for a week or two together. And he said, hey, what are you doing tonight? And I said, I don't know, nothing. Writing notes, finishing up, getting some rest for the weekend. And he said, why don't you drive up with me to camp? I'm going to, tidy up, just check in up there, make sure everything's going okay. And I said, what do you mean? What camp? Tell me a little bit more about this. So we drove up. We didn't get here till after nightfall, some Friday night. This was back in 2004 or so. And that was my first exposure to it. And I just got to see a different piece of the program, if you will, with regards to everything that we as a medical care team might involve ourselves with when it comes to caring for kids with diabetes. And that was my first exposure to it. Over the years, obviously, I've had opportunities to kind of take on a little bit greater and greater role. I spent a week as a fellow here just helping with the medical management of the first year I was here, and then took a couple years off, so to speak, when I had my own children and didn't have the convenience of coming to camp. But in the last several years, Ernie's re-invited me to play a bigger and bigger role, and here we are.
Very cool. Well, that's quite a story. And as you said, you've been with UT Southwestern since 2001. And in 2008, you assumed the position of director of the pediatrics clerkship. And also, I noticed just sort of reading your background, the White Hat Award. Do you remember getting that? That's pretty neat among your colleagues to receive that.
Yeah, it is. It's with a lot of humility that I say, it's pretty cool. The White Hat Award in our residency program is is awarded to one of the graduating residents in the year of their graduation based on a vote of their co-residence as to the colleague of theirs who they would most want to care for their own child should the need ever arise. So just the way that that is phrased and what it says about the respect that you've earned from your colleagues over the course of 3 years of really rubbing shoulders with them, you know, in the trenches, so to speak, and working hard with them, day hours, night hours, et cetera, et cetera. That was really a nice honor.
Sounds like a UT Southwestern version of the Code of Living Award, huh?
It's got a lot of parallels, yeah, for sure.
That's cool.
What would you say is the most satisfying part of your involvement with Camp Sweeney?
I mean, the gratitude, without question, right? I guess at some level, it's the growth you see in the kids as they experience camp and experience everything else that they do as they grow and mature. But the gratitude you get back in return as they come back, whether it be at camp, because some of these kids I only see at camp, but, you know, some of these kids I have the privilege of being involved with their care, not only in camp, but outside of camp, as I try to encourage a handful of, or as many of my families that are interested to think about it at least. And that, you just can't beat that.
And as we sort of start to talk about the treatment of diabetes, I mean, let's just sort of take us back in time, the sort of rudimentary, you know, slow to change style of treating and caring for diabetes, and sort of take us back to the beginning and what was that like back then?
Oof, the beginning. You're gonna make people think I'm older than I am. No, it's interesting because last year we, and by we I mean the world at large, really tried to bring attention to the history of diabetes a fair bit more than in a typical year, because it was the 100th anniversary of the discovery of insulin, which is crazy if you think about it, because that means we've had insulin to treat people with type 1 diabetes for 100 years. So when I started hearing about the 100th anniversary of insulin, I started kind of asking myself, wait, what do we do for people with diabetes before we had insulin? And it doesn't take too much to kind of, you know, start doing a little bit of research online about what's the long-term history of this, which I'm not going to speak to any personal experience with or anything. But the crazy part of all this to me is there are written records of what sounds like diabetes dating back about, of what sounds like type 1 diabetes dating back about 3,000 years.
Wow.
Because there are just written records of people who are peeing a lot, drinking a lot, losing weight, and getting very sick and having no viable treatment that they would respond to, dating back 3,000 years. And then, I mean, you know, obviously there's a long gap between then and the discovery of insulin 100 years ago, but the discovery of insulin is its own story with regards to just what a dramatic turnaround it made in such short order for kids as recently as kids or adults, as recently as 100 years ago. Type 1 diabetes was a diagnosis with a fatal prognosis. And as hard it is as it is to, you know, say that and to confront that for what we do, that was the reality of the condition as recently as 101 years ago. So that's a hard thing to confront sometimes. But when insulin was initially discovered, I mean, you had children or adults. The first person to ever be treated with insulin, as history has recorded things, I think is actually a 14-year-old. Who within a few weeks was just, you know, experiencing all of the recovery and clinical improvement that we see now just hundreds of times over every year at any large children's hospital, as we see children who are newly diagnosed with diabetes and get them started on insulin. But the modern history of things is equally interesting to me, A, because I've lived it, and B, because the pace of progress in the last 5 or 7 years has just been so dramatic. And at some level, we've lived that at camp because we've had to reinvent just our approach to how we're going to provide care for kids at camp in so many different ways because of the progress in technology and the progress in therapeutics that have really been mushrooming over the course of the last few years. And these are the, you know, things that kids bring to us now saying, this is what I do to take care of myself at home. And I think one of our approaches at camp has long been, we're going to try our best to say yes. If a family approaches us and says, this is what I do to take care of myself or to take care of my child at home, and it's working really well, then who are we to say, well, come to camp, but you can't do what you do at home. Mm-hmm. We're going to restrict you to our way of doing things. I mean, there are certain restrictions we have to place for purposes of being able to take care of 250, 260 kids at once. But for the most part, our attitude has been one of, especially with regards to technology, we would like to be able to let you continue however you want to. And truthfully, that means if you want to come off all your tech for 3 weeks while you're at camp, that's fine. Mm-hmm. If you want to stay on all your tech, let's try to make that work. That's been more and more challenging over the course of the last few years because the technology has just exploded in terms of variety and all the different types of tools that people might bring to camp.
But that is sort of a more of a real world approach. I mean, right? I mean, not trying to change what works already for these kids.
Yeah. And I think at some level, I mean, it starts with certainly I and my personal, you know, kind of approach to diabetes care. I'm a big believer in the potential of technology. I'm never going to approach any individual family and say, look, you need to have your child on this or you need to have your child on that, because I think any individual family's choice is as important as anything as far as making those decisions that's right for their family and that's right for their child. But the potential to, if you just leave quality of life even out of it for a minute, the potential from a glycemic control standpoint itself, just to control blood sugars with some of the things that modern technology can bring to the table, is different than the tools that our kids used to have available to themselves, you know, as recently as 5-7 years ago.
Yeah, it does seem like there has been a massive jump just in recent, 5 to 8 years or so. But, you know, sort of going back to, you know, so insulin's 101 years old now. And what would you say was maybe the biggest jump in care, in the structure of care from, like, you know, 100 years ago to, let's say, the 60s? Was there some, you know, in testing, you know, we went from urine testing to blood testing primarily, right? I mean, was that sort of the biggest jump?
I think I would highlight a couple of different things. It's easy now in hindsight to say, hey, blood sugar control is really important. But in medical, in the kind of trajectory of diabetes care and from the medical perspective, there was a really important trial over the course of the early 1980s that really extended even for several years past that, called the DCCT, or the Diabetes Control and Complications Trial. And that was the first time that the medical community got together, and it was a multi-center trial across a number of medical centers all across the U.S. and some centers outside the U.S. as well, that got together and prospectively approached the treatment of people with diabetes, type 1 and type 2, and said, we're going to intensively treat a certain cohort of subjects, and we're going to less intensively treat another cohort of subjects. And we're going to see if blood sugar control really matters in terms of medical outcomes, renal outcomes, kidney failure, eye outcomes, visual issues, cardiac issues. And without a doubt, blood sugar control was shown to be of utmost importance in the long-term outcomes of people with diabetes. Easy to just accept as the truth today. But mm-hmm. somebody had to go to the effort to really document that that actually does matter. If you were just set on a natural trajectory that was unavoidable, regardless of how you took care of your blood sugars from the day you were diagnosed from that point forward, then our whole approach to diabetes would be very different today. But because we began to learn that actually blood sugar control matters, and it matters a lot, it really just added emphasis on, okay, well, how do we do this better? And it would be remiss of me, I think, to not mention in that same breath that the reality is, for all the tools that we can talk about, all the new tools that have come online in the last few years, people with diabetes still struggle to maintain or to achieve their blood sugar control targets that would be considered ideal, quote unquote, because it's hard. It's not easy on a day by day basis. It's not easy on a month by month basis. So we have a long way to go, meaning despite all the tools, despite any new medications, despite all the support services and everything else, the reality is 20-25% of kids and adults meet their blood sugar targets. So we've got a long way to go.
Yeah. We've talked to lots of different kids, you know, before, and actually had a podcast with M. Musial, one of our campers. And I asked her about from today to tomorrow, you know, all of a sudden it can be totally different as far as your blood sugar levels. Yeah. And she said, yeah, I'll eat the exact same thing, do the exact same thing. And then the next day it's, even though I'm doing the same thing, it goes out of whack.
Yeah. And people know that because they live it. But, you know, outside of individual lived experience, people have documented this too in terms of, you know, just, and we don't use some of this anymore, but when I started in fellowship, and a lot of the people listening to this broadcast will kind of remember, we used to treat kids with NPH, one of the older insulins, and, you know, regular or some of the shorter acting insulins, more rapid acting insulins were just kind of coming online and becoming a little bit more prevalent by then. But NPH in a controlled research environment, if you admit somebody to a research facility and put them on a fixed schedule from day to day where they are burning the same number of calories every day, and you feed them a controlled meal, and then you measure how much sugar you have to give them to essentially maintain their blood sugar targets within a very tight range, varied in its day-to-day effect by 40%. If everything else you could hold steady was held steady.
Wow.
So modern insulins have gotten a little bit better in terms of that, but you know that puts a number to that perception in ways that, again, just reiterates that point of, well, we've got a long ways to go.
Wow, that's 40%. That's wow.
I imagine when you were talking about the technology and families, and they come in and they're like, well, this is what we do. Do they ever surprise you that your opinion about like a pump or whatever might be, this is how you manage with this device, and then they come in with something different? Does it surprise you?
I mean, at some point you stop getting surprised because surprise becomes a norm, right? So I think everybody approaches things uniquely and differently. And one of the great things about the diabetes community is if you want to be a part of the community, meaning as a patient, the, you know, people find their tribe in the 2020s, right? So the diabetes community has certainly found itself, meaning it's a little bit less isolating, I think, than it used to be, because you can find other people and hear that, you know, this other family who maybe has some similar circumstances as you is doing things a certain way, and they may not live anywhere close to you, but you steal an idea from them. And then this other family is doing some other piece of their care a certain way, and you steal an idea from them, and you're connected through social media or whatever else that, you know, connects families these days. So it's great. I think, you know, we can talk about it if the conversation goes in that direction. But one of the biggest examples of that probably is all the do-it-yourself loopers that, you know, really kind of looked modern diabetes care as it was supposed to be in the eye and said, yeah, that's not good enough for me, for my family. So I want something different for my kid or for myself. And they've really taken, you know, diabetes care by a chokehold from the standpoint of, I want to take it in this direction. I don't really care what the regulatory agencies say. I want this, and I think it's better for me and for my lifestyle or for my kid and my kid's long-term health. And I think that's been one of our points of pride at camp is, you know, when we talk about, well, we want to say yes, we want to try to say yes to families. I can't think of a better example than that, than of our willingness to meet families whose children are looping. And a lot of people listening to this will understand what that means and say, yeah, you can keep looping at camp. There's not too many places across the country that you can send your kid off to camp for 3 weeks on, you know, the type of care regimen that some of those kids follow.
Well, we've sort of touched on the technology advancements here in the last 5 to 8 years, and I'd like to talk more about that here in just a moment, right after this break.
Camp Sweeney is more than just a camp. It's a place where young people with diabetes can develop the skills they need to live long and healthy lives. Our campers participate in a program that offers them a wide variety of activities, including archery, swimming, challenge course, hiking, and canoeing. While participating in these activities, our campers build self-confidence, develop new skills, and meet people their own age who also have diabetes. And let's not forget, a session at Camp Sweeney is a lot of fun. If you'd like to change the life of a child by sponsoring him or her to attend our camp, please contact Southwestern Diabetic Foundation at 940-665-2011 or log on to www.campsweeney.org. We're a nonprofit organization. Camp Sweeney is where friendship begins and never ends. And now, back to the Sweeney Connection, a presentation of Camp Sweeney and KPFC-FM, and your host, Chad Henderson.
All right, visiting with Dr. Shomo Adhikari, and we sort of touched on the technology part and the advancement of treatment in the last 5 to 8 years, and sort of what has been the biggest advancement in the last, 5 to 8 years in treatment?
Yeah, it's interesting. We talk about the long-term history of things and such. It's kind of scary if you think about the timeline of things that, blood sugar meters weren't even available until the early 1980s, meaning we think about all the modern things that our kids do. And just as recently as 40 years ago, we couldn't even send a child with type 1 diabetes home with a blood sugar meter. So it's tough for me to think about the more recent changes and developments of things and compare it to something like that, because I didn't experience that. By the time I became involved from a medical perspective in the care of kids with diabetes, we already had some of those things that we took for granted, right? But it would be, again, just remiss of me not to mention that actually there were significant developments before I ever joined the fray, so to speak. So blood sugar meters, early 1980s, CGMs didn't really begin to infiltrate commercial use in any kind of way until just the last 15 to 20 years. Now, today, continuous glucose monitors are all but standard of care. I mean, from our practice's standpoint, about 70 to 80% of our kids are on one or another continuous glucose monitor. I have a number of devices in front of me on the table here today. Some of these are insulin pumps. Some of them are continuous glucose monitors. Insulin pumps have been on the market now for over a couple decades. But the thing that I think is most exciting to me as we move forward into the next few years is the connections between these devices and the automation that's being introduced into the market and into the, kind of armamentarium of the tools that kids and families have to help care for them, to help care for themselves. I think medical outcomes aside, one of the things that really stands out for me every time I say, hey, we've got a long ways to go, is just the cognitive burden of type 1 diabetes, whether it's for the patient or for the parent who's taking care of their child, is so significant. And I think the promise of tomorrow, so to speak, of near-term tomorrow, is to diminish the cognitive burden if the tools can be refined and if people will learn to take advantage of the tools to their fullest capacity. I think there is a horizon beyond that that we're just beginning to kind of scrape the surface of, because now we're beginning to also just touch on immunologic approaches to diabetes care. And just in the last couple of months, there's been a new drug approved to delay the onset of type 1 diabetes in somebody who is known to be high risk of developing type 1 diabetes. What does that begin to do in terms of bending the needle once it gets out there in larger numbers in terms of its use? And then there's, I think, another pipeline of, there's just been a whole array of new types of drugs for adults with type 2 diabetes that have come on the market in the course of the last 5 to 7 years. And we're just beginning to scrape the surface of, might some of these be beneficial as supplements, not as replacements to insulin, but as supplements to insulin for some of our kids with type 1 diabetes as well. So I'm excited about all three of those pathways.
What are the devices? Which are the ones that parents can monitor from their phones?
So we've got two here. I don't know what the camera is able to pick up really well, but I think most folks will know that there's three CGMs on the market now in the U.S. Actually, four, but three of them are approved for kids. We've got two of them here. One is a Freestyle brand, which is a little disc that many people are familiar with. This is the Freestyle Libre. If you are familiar with the latest developments in this. We've had hundreds of kids at camp on freestyles in the last couple of years. The nice thing about 2022 and thinking about the summer of 2023 now is if someone is looking at this, then you know that this is actually the dated platform because this is the quote unquote Freestyle Libre 2. And just within the last couple of months, Freestyle has introduced their third generation sensor. So their Freestyle Libre 3 is really the size of a penny. I don't have a penny in front of me, but it's much smaller, no longer requires scanning. So it brings some of the continuous data streaming that families have been used to now with the Dexcom suite of products, which is the next thing that you see here again. Already dated in that this is the Dexcom G6. We've had kids wearing the G6 now for, gosh, 3 or 4 years at camp. And many of our families will be very familiar with this. And many of our families will also be very excited about the fact that just within the last couple of weeks now, Dexcom's had their next generation sensor also approved by the FDA. It's not actually commercially available yet, but the G7 is now, you know, going to be on the market within the next couple of months. And I know that as a medical staff, we're super excited about getting all our protocols revised again for this summer with regards to what are the things we need to install on our phones and hook up to our computers and everything else to make sure that we can take advantage of all the kids who come in on this year's latest technology.
So where do those things mount? Where do they attach?
You can attach them. The Libres are still only approved to be attached on the back of your arm. Mm-hmm. So on either side, kind of on the just backside of your arm. The Dexcoms are really approved to be worn in many other places. So some families will choose to have it on their child's stomachs, meaning on their abdomens, just near their umbilicus. Some people will wear it right above their kind of backside, right on their upper buttocks. You can also wear it on the arms. So the Dexcom has a little bit more flexibility. And the way that these things work is they will, depending on the model, I want to be careful in how I say this because it's tempting to say, oh, they check your blood sugar. What it's really important to remember is they check your skin sugar. They check the sugar level of your subcutaneous tissue. So if you are a parent of a child who's not wearing a CGM now and you are considering whether it might be right for your child, the things to kind of take into consideration are, A, yeah, they have to be okay. And so you have to be okay with the fact that they will have something that is constantly attached to them. With that, for some, comes a little bit of a burden of, I'm constantly reminded that I have diabetes and I don't want that. And we respect that if that's the case. And that's why so many kids come to camp and say they want a tech holiday, so to speak. But mm-hmm. with that, with the willingness to do it, comes so much more information. Because for years, before we had CGMs available, we would ask our kids to check their blood sugar 4, 5, 6 times a day. And we would look at these logs and families would look at these logs and see, hey, my blood sugar is this at breakfast and this at lunch and this at dinner. But in between, did you go up and down? Did you spike and crash? Did you fall and recover? If you did this in between breakfast and lunch as opposed to this, you might need a very different intervention to try to get you more what we want, which is a slight rise after meals, coming back, coasting back into a healthy number by the next meal. So having that interval information is so important. And then the software that comes along with these nowadays can really do a lot of just number averaging and give you a sense of what your child's blood sugars have been with over the course of a couple of weeks, couple of days, a few months, with significantly less effort than you used to have to require. And then there's a connectivity piece to it that I also want to mention, which is I can be a parent at work from 8 to 5 and my son's at school and I can look down at my phone at any point in time and know what their blood sugar is, even if they are hundreds of miles away from me. And in fact, if I want to, I can even set the system to notify me with a little beep or a little alarm if their blood sugar is getting out of whatever range I want to be notified for. So again, with that comes this need for a balancing act because mm-hmm. you can drive yourself crazy with notifications, or you can also bring yourself some peace of mind that you have this at least sense of control that, well, if things get really awry, I know that I will be notified. So it just depends on somebody's mindset as to where in that spectrum they want to fall.
Is there certain points of the body that are better than others to have these attached to you?
That's so incredibly variable from person to person, because some people will, you know, swear by one site or another. Some people say, you know, my Dexcom really only works, or it's only accurate if it's on my stomach, on my belly. But another person will come in my very next visit and say, no, it doesn't matter for me at all. So that's a little bit of trial and error with regards to, you know, what works for one person doesn't always work for another.
And sort of with this technology, I mean, with the real-time, you know, information and the connectivity, and I just wonder, I know that technology was a big goal for the new medical center to sort of future-proof a little bit, and I just wonder how all these devices, you know, tie into our medical center here at Camp Sweeney. And is there real-time monitoring, and is the med staff going to know everything? I mean, just take me through that process.
Yeah, it's every year has been a little bit different the last couple of years, because it's really just been the last 2 to 3 years that we've kind of been confronted with this wave of everyone wearing CGMs at camp, or a number of kids wearing CGMs at camp has really exploded. And with that, we've tried to ask ourselves, well, what do we do with all this information? Do we look at it? Do we not look at it? Do we process it in all of our hour-to-hour, day-to-day, you know, dose adjustments? So every year we've done a little bit more. Last year we had a whole wall of people. A lot of people listening to this will kind of know. When I describe that you can wear this, you know, this either of these sensors, and if I'm a parent, I can kind of know what my child's blood sugar is. Well, the reality is, using those apps, if I happen to have 10 kids with diabetes, I could know all of their blood sugars. So at camp, we don't have a parent who has 10 kids with diabetes, but we in the medical center will treat ourselves as the parent of 150 kids at camp who might be wearing CGMs. So last summer at camp, for example, we took our first attempt at just putting a bunch of iPads on the wall at the medical center, all of whom were connected to this iPad might be connected to 4 or 5 kids. This iPad might be connected to 7 or 8 kids. And as long as they are as long as the kids in their cabins or wherever they are at camp are carrying a camp phone and they didn't swipe the app up, meaning their app is still running in the background and they're wearing their CGM, then we can literally just look over at the wall and we know what their blood sugars are. That in and of itself is helpful, but what that really does is it opens up the ability to go beyond the camp medical record when it comes time to ask ourselves, hey, this child had a low, or this child had a high at camp yesterday. What do we want to do tomorrow that's different than today? Lots of times that decision is easy enough just by looking at the camp medical record, because the camp medical record tells me what their blood sugar was at breakfast and it tells me what their blood sugar was at lunch. And if they ever poke their finger in between reactions, as we like to call them, it tells me what their blood sugar was every single time. They could check their blood sugar at the doc and the camp medical record will have that in the system. But for those kids who don't check as often, or for those kids who are having excess lows or highs, because they're carrying a camp-issued phone, because they're wearing a CGM, I can now log into a camp Dexcom account and see their trends since they got at camp, and Dexcom checks their blood sugar or skin sugar every 5 minutes, and just get a much fuller and much richer picture of what their blood sugars have been doing since their arrival to camp. And we've tried to merge a lot of that new software with our reliance on Session FE, which is our camp medical record. The difficulty with that process is Session FE was made before such a thing as a CGM existed. So I know, you know, we're well into construction on the camp medical center itself, one of the next construction projects, quote unquote, I think, in Dr. Ernie's minds and certainly my own as well, is how do we modernize the camp medical record to really better interface with this? Because right now what we have to do is just log in through a web browser to a software suite that doesn't talk to the medical record. How do we get these things to talk to each other a little bit better? That's one of many things on the roadmap for that down the road.
And sort of final question for me is, we're a lot of great information, but, you know, and you've sort of already touched on it maybe with the automation and just sort of lessening the cognitive burden. But, you know, where do you see us with treatment in, you know, 5 to 10 years from now?
Gosh, if I think about how far we've come in the last 5 years, it's so hard for me to say I have any sense of where are we going to be 5 years from now, because I bet there's going to be a few things that come along that I haven't even thought about yet. Mm-hmm. But leaving that aside for a minute, I do think that, you know, as I reflect on where we are today, the things that I see as huge opportunities is the infiltration of this automation is still pretty low overall. It's rising, and it's rising, you know, at least multiplicatively, if not exponentially, but it's still fairly low. I think there are huge opportunities for us as a medical society, as a just support society and as general society to begin to try to address some of the socioeconomic gaps in terms of how do we bring some of these newer therapies, advanced therapies, automation, newer drugs, whatever we want to consider it, to the next, you know, cohort of patients mm-hmm. who haven't been amongst the early adopters. And as I reflect on, you know, what are we trying to strive for in our practice at Children's and UT Southwestern, we care for about 2,500 kids with diabetes at any given year, about 2,000 kids with type 1, about 500 kids with type 2. And, you know, we look carefully at year to year, how are we progressing in terms of all of these things, in terms of utilization globally, but especially as our utilization numbers have gotten a little bit more appreciable and actually measurable, then you begin to identify those gaps in, okay, well, yeah, our numbers are of utilization are getting better, but look, this cohort of the population is really lagging behind. And mm-hmm. I think there's language barriers and socioeconomic barriers and a lot of other things that contribute to that. So utilization of the technology is a big piece of it. I think above and beyond that, mental health support. I mean, as a, again, just as a system, this is not unique to diabetes, but kids have been under so much added mental distress in the last few years. And I think, you know, when I ask myself every so often, you know, well, why do I stay as involved in camp as I do? I think of that angle as much as anything in terms of, wait, what are we really accomplishing at camp? And I think of how do we stay on the leading edge? How do we stay on the cusp of, you know, how really understanding all the various dynamics that affect the mental health of our teens and our, you know, younger children with diabetes, because all of these tools and everything else is great unless you're so struggling with various aspects of your life, be it the medical aspect, be it another aspect, that you're really not able to utilize that. So add to that a couple of the things that I kind of just loosely touched on with mm-hmm. regards to immunologic therapies, new drugs, things like that. Those are some of the big things that I see on the horizon.
Interesting. Bob, any final thoughts?
No, just the, I've read off and on things about artificial pancreas. What's, is that even any kind of reality or?
I mean, the term artificial pancreas in its, you know, most kind of honest form, I guess, because people use artificial pancreases or the term artificial pancreas to describe some of our modern pumps. And that's fair. I recognize why, because at the end of the day, your pancreas produces insulin, produces more insulin if your blood sugar is rising, produces less if your blood sugar is falling, does a whole bunch of other things, of course, including one of the newer, you know, one of the things to come online in the next few years, I think, will be your pancreas also produces glucagon if your blood sugar is falling, and insulin pumps don't. But we are well underway now into kind of beginning to study bi-hormonal insulin pumps. So when people use the word artificial pancreas, I think in its most honest form, they're probably at some level beginning to really think about an insulin pump that can give you insulin if your blood sugar is rising. But today's insulin pumps can shut off insulin if your blood sugar is falling, right? I always kind of make the analogy to driving when I'm talking about this with a family. That's great that you can let off the accelerator pedal if you want to slow down. But if you can never, if you could never push a brake, you would never push your accelerator too high. In an insulin pump, once we introduce the ability to give glucagon as well, meaning once we introduce a brake into the system, we'll be able to change our algorithms for how much insulin does your pump automatically give you if your blood sugar is rising, because the algorithm will allow it, will be able to be much more aggressive as soon as you introduce that brake into the system. So I think the concept of an artificial pancreas to me means a bi-hormonal insulin pump, one that will be able to give insulin at varying rates and be able to give glucagon. And we know that there's one that's going to be, you know, inviting participants to participate in research trials very soon. And we're super excited to see what that might bring.
Wow. That's cool.
That is very cool. Well, Dr. Adhikari, thank you so much for being on the Swinney Connection today on this episode and lots of great information.
Thanks for having me.
Looking forward to a summer 2023.
Absolutely.
Extraordinary.
That's absolutely right. For Bob Cannon and our technical director, Joe Languel, I'm Chad Henderson, and Camp Swinney, you stay connected.
The preceding program has been a presentation of Camp Swinney and KPFC-FM. No portion of this broadcast may be reproduced or distributed without the express written permission of Camp Swinney. This is your announcer, Everett Caldwell, wishing you a good night from Camp Swinney. You're listening to KPFC-FM 91.9, serving Kalispell, Gainesville, and the entire Swinneyland area.